speak today, or to chair a meeting, and when I picked the topic, a gentleman named Earl had called me. I called him back, and I said, I've chosen a topic, and I prayed about it because I asked God to pretty much guide me in every aspect of my life. And God told me, alcoholism as a disease, or that sex thing that you do so well. And I kept praying about it and thinking about it, and I called Earl back, and I didn't know Earl. I said, Earl, are you sitting down? And he said, yeah. And I said, I'm going to give a meeting on sexual healing and the sexual effects of alcoholism. And there was this dead silence. And I said, Earl, are you there? And I thought of that Dixie Chick song, you know, Earl's got to die. But I didn't want to be the one to murder him. Be responsible for that, too. And I said, Earl, do you have a problem with that? Oh, I don't have a problem with that, he said. I don't have a problem with that. So I said, okay. But could you send me an outline or something so the committee doesn't eat me alive? I said, sure, I can do that. So why do I like to speak about this or talk about this? Because when I came into this program, I was taught, and this was part of the opening in every meeting that I went to, they told me, alcoholism is a disease. It's threefold. That affects the alcoholic emotionally, physically, spiritually, and it's a progressive disease. And if the alcoholic stops drinking and drinks again in 6 days, 6 weeks, 6 months, 6 years, it takes a short period of time before he or she is drinking like they used to. He said there's no cure for this. You know, there's abstinence. But it usually, if not abstained from, an alcoholic can die, be incarcerated, go insane. How scary is this when you love an alcoholic? And I'm thinking, oh, my God, you know, this is what I'm living with. I had no idea. They said, you didn't cause it. You can't cure it. But I could cure everything. Can't control it. I came to learn, though, and I add to that definition, that I can contribute to this disease. I can do that either in a negative or a positive way, by my actions, my attitudes, my beliefs, so on and so forth, my games that I play. I also learned that alcoholics are sometimes affected financially and sexually, and that's not part of what you read, and that I, too, can be affected in all those ways, physically, emotionally, spiritually, financially, and sexually, if I am associated with or love or have been affected by somebody's alcoholism. I say alcoholism, not drinking, because alcoholism is so much more than drinking. You know, I know people that say I was an alcoholic just waiting for the first drink. And I can see that. Some of us may have children that we recognize those behaviors and attitudes in. When I came into the program and I got real serious real quick because I wanted out of the pain. Pain is a great motivator. And today I can let my loved ones have their pain because I know how much it changed my life. And letting somebody have their own pain is actually giving them a gift. And I don't have a problem doing that today. I think that I probably lived most of my life in pain. I was born qualified for this program. I had a grandfather that was an alcoholic. So it trickled down through the family. My father grew up with this alcoholic, violent alcoholic that said he'd settle things behind the barn. And my dad left home when he was 16 years old. And so my father, in my opinion, kind of died on the inside to survive that. And although I love my dad to death, I was closer to him than I was my mom, I always thought, you know, I just never really knew who he was. And consequently, I attract men the same that just like my father. And those are the ones that are hard workers, because that's what dad was, and a good family man, and all of those positive traits about my dad. And the one common thread is that you never really know who they are. And that's really common in alcoholics and addicts. You just don't connect on an emotional level. And I'm comfortable there. That was my first male relationship. That's what my relationship with my father was all about. But prior to any of that, I want to tell you that in my recovery, I have experienced a healing of sexual wounds, attitudes, and behaviors. And I have learned about my sexual behaviors and reactions in the same way I've become aware of my character defects. In layers. A little bit at a time, something is revealed to me. And I never liked the word denial, and I just heard our AA speaker say there was no such thing. But I've heard that denial is a form of God's grace.
And you know, that's really loving.
Because if God had revealed everything that I needed to look at about myself in one big shopping trip, so to speak, it would have blown me away. So little by little in layers, I become aware that, oh, there's this pain. I don't like the way this feels. I need to do something about it. And that's that awareness. That's the first day I become aware of it. And then I look at it, and I turn it upside down, and I investigate, and I talk to others, and I journal, and I accept what it is. And eventually I have to take action. Sex is a subject that we don't hear a lot about in this program. We don't talk about it in meetings. I don't know if we're not comfortable or we're embarrassed or what the story might be. But it is mentioned in several pieces of our conference-approved literature. Our very first publication, Al-Anon Family Groups, refers to sex as the sex problem. Okay? And the dilemma of the alcoholic marriage uplifts us with the title, Sex in the Alcoholic Marriage. And the Blueprint for Progress asks us, have I honestly assessed my feelings about sex and my sexual relationships? How many of you have done that Blueprint for Progress and just kind of faded over that? You don't even remember that it's in that book. As if living with another beginning, sobriety wasn't... Well, that doesn't make any sense. Let me go back. There's a book called Living with Sobriety, and that also mentions the sexual relationship. So it's there. It runs through our program and our literature, but it's just not something that we talk a lot about. I started being affected sexually before I was able to define myself even as a sexual being. I went to parochial schools. I developed early, and they knew what I was doing. They knew it. Teachers in the school, and I by no means mean this to be against the religion. It has to do with an individual's behavior is really what it boils down to, a few individuals' behavior. But I was judged because of the way that I looked, and I was told you can't take a shortcut home from school through the wooded area because you will lead the boys into temptation. Give me the power. I will lead the boys into temptation. Okay, I didn't know how I was going to do this, but I was going to lead those boys into temptation. And the rules for me were different. It was keep your shirt buttoned to the top and so on and so forth. And I was shamed. I was shamed for my being a female, and I was shamed for what appeared, I guess, to be my sexuality. And in fifth grade, I had a male teacher that walked me up and down the sidewalk holding my hand. Today, this wouldn't be acceptable while the other kids played dodgeball. And he'd say, you know, you're growing up too fast. If you continue to do all the things that you're doing, there's not going to be anything to look forward to. And my obedient generation, you know, I walked and I thought, what is he talking about? Well, what am I doing? You know, I really didn't know. I had no idea where these people were coming from because I hadn't thought of myself as a sexual being. I was an 11-year-old child. Standing up against these people that brought me their issues, I suppose. That's really what it boiled down to. But it laid the groundwork for effects that would mount up throughout the years. And this continued through high school and, you know, the gossip and the rumors. And I've given meetings before. One time, Mary Ann, our speaker for tomorrow, I went to her meeting. And I had decided I was going to talk on this topic, and I was the youngest person there. She can tell you about that home group meeting, but there's women there that are in their 80s, and I was like, and I'm going to talk about this topic, and oh my gosh. So it was like talking to my grandmother. But, you know, one of the things that I think about is that, you know, if you are 80 years old and you're comfortable with where that is because you're not in a relationship, that part of your life is, you know, is set. Think about the sexuality part in terms of that criticism that you might put on others, you know, because they may be big-busted or they may be attractive people. I've come to know in my program that God created me, and I am a physical, emotional, spiritual, sexual being, and that for me to be whole, I need to look at all aspects of that. I had no choice. There were things at the core of me that kept screaming, and I needed to look at them. I am the kind of gal that attracts a guy that doesn't wear his ego on his sleeve. I like the more quiet kind. You know, the kind you can kind of pry open. You know, one of those. Not the one that's flamboyant and out there because they're like in your face. But I'd rather have one that I can pry open and take those feelings out one at a time and I can teach them, you know, how to deal with their emotions and so on and so forth. So consequently, that was a mistake that her female came in. Because one of the things that I've come to know after repeated years of minimal sex life and after my threats that I would leave, that I would have affairs, that one man's trash is another man's gold, so on and so forth. You know, I've come to know that I have a part in this. Because this is part of the package that I attract and that I want. Because I don't want that womanizer kind of guy that's out there, you know, ready to go Monday through Sunday. And that's been what I've dealt with. My first marriage took place, are you ready? Because I know you probably don't think I'm too much older than this, when I was 16. Yeah, it was like, this will give away my age. It was Vietnam War time. And I was barely in kindergarten. And no, it was Vietnam War time and I was 16. And my boyfriend's family was splitting up and he needed a home. And I guess I was just crying, you know, for being that caretaker. I will be your home. I am 16. Let's get married. Well, actually, what happened is I thought I was pregnant. And when my mother found that out, my mother insisted that we get married. And we'll just leave that story short. And we got married. And almost immediately, I knew that I had walked into a world that I had never lived in before. This man had pornography that he kept in a drawer and swore that I looked at it while he was at work. Now, I wasn't sure that if I did, why that was like a really big thing, but these were the accusations. And he was a man that, when I said, living with you makes me really unhappy, he would hold a shotgun to my head and tell me to pull the trigger. And he was a man that would burn my clothes if somebody said they had saw me that day and I looked attractive. And what's the point? The point is this. Again, there's that message. To look good is not a good thing. You better deny this part of yourself. You better not enjoy or celebrate this because this brings negativity into your life. And I, as soon as I could, got out of that marriage and moved on. And when I got out of that marriage, my goal, and all of this violence and this abuse and almost losing my life and the crazy pornography thing, and don't forget I was 16 years old. What I come to know today about that is that I was affected by him in 3.5 years of marriage as though I was abused as a child living with parents because I was 16 years old. And a 16-year-old, I know from experience, is not emotionally able to deal with that kind of stuff. And another layer laid there. And I left that marriage with one goal. And it was to prove to myself that I was desirable. Because he assured me that I was not. So shortly thereafter, I proved to myself that I was. And what damage did I do to myself? And how did I use people? And you know, it's usually men that stand someplace and say they used women. I used men. I used men because the society always told me that you look good, it's not good, but the people closest to me were treating me differently than that. And the words and the actions behind closed doors, they didn't go together. And how many times do we live with that in an alcoholic home? The words and the actions don't go together. And what confusion this created in me. Single for about 5 years, I met the man of my dreams. My soulmate. Truthfully, the sex was great. And we were so connected. And I hope all of you have been there at some point in time because it's really something special to be able to share yourself on that level with someone. And I was at the top of the totem pole in his life.
And the time, years went by, and I dropped on the totem pole. And he went up on my totem pole. In other words, I was his obsession in the beginning. And as the years went on, it was drugs and alcohol. And he was my obsession. And Marianne told a joke in the slogan meeting this morning about why can't the Al-Anon keep her eyes open during sex with the alcoholic? And she said it's because, you know, we really don't like to see them have a good time. But in reality, for me, it was because it got too painful. And what was lost over the years was looking right back at me. And after I came into the program and my husband went into AA, I would cry every time we got together on that level. Because we lost so much. Or I had. I had lost so much. The broken promises and the lies and all that goes with alcoholism for some of you, you know, infidelities. I don't know that I dealt with that in my marriage, and that's probably by the grace of God, you know, because if that had happened and I knew about it, my husband would probably be dead and I'd be where Johnny used to live, in prison somewhere. So, but the infidelities, the broken promises, the lies, the who are you, and everything that goes with that alcoholism put a barrier. I couldn't be emotionally free with this person. Come to understand that my sexual being is really at my core. That's not to say that my spiritual self isn't. It is. And these kind of men that I attract, again, they're not... And I think this is a facade anyway, that men are always ready to go. Not the men I know, you know. What men? You know? I don't know. I'm thinking somebody told him that once, and it's just a rumor that continued to go on for all of eternity. But anyway. So consequently, you know, like we've been blamed maybe for their drinking, or which wasn't my case, but I took on that I was being rejected. I took that on in my first marriage. I took that on in my second marriage. That I was being rejected. And my husband would say to me, I desire you. You know I love you. And I do know that he loves me. I knew that he loved me for 13 years of insanity and alcoholism in our marriage. And now, being married for 26 years, I know he loves me. There's no doubt in my mind. But does he grab me and throw me down? And no. So, but then I don't meet him in saran wrap either. So, it's too expensive, and I've got larger. I'm kidding. But anyway. And you know, it's a miracle that I can laugh about this today, because this has caused so much pain in my life. It really has. So I used to make my threats, and I used to tell him how he wasn't that good anyway, and I came to realize that I was my own worst enemy. That very often in my life, I was the reason that I didn't get what I wanted. Would you want to have sex with me after I threatened you? Would you want to have sex with me after I told you how good you weren't? How crazy. But again, like the AA speaker spoke earlier, there was a problem, but nobody really knew what the problem was. And until you identify that, what are you going to do about it? You just kind of go in circles around and around and around. And that's what I did. And I did it all alone. It had nothing to do with my husband or anyone in my life. But I stayed committed because, like I told a friend earlier today, you know, we Al-Anons, we stay committed when there's nothing to be committed to. We just kind of hang out there just being committed. Until somebody thinks that we ought to be committed, or we know it ourselves. And, you know, that truly is, I was at a place where I should have been committed when I came in here. Anyway, the healing happened in layers, and I had to look at my past. I want to tell you something really neat that happened. God works miracles in all areas of our lives. He doesn't care if it's sex or what it is. This man that was my teacher in fifth grade that used to walk and criticize me and judge me and tell me things that I didn't know what he was saying. One day, about 3 years ago, I do a lot of service in my program in Missouri, and this man called me and he said, I called the Highland Center and they gave me your name to call. And he said, I have a parishioner that needs an Al-Anon meeting. And I was wondering if it was okay if I gave her your number. And I said, sure. And I said again, what is your name? It was him, the fifth grade teacher. And I was working on this. And I pray. I always tell God, give me a sign. Give me what I need. Give me the meat so I can slice and dice it, you know. Just give me it. And I say, God doesn't give me signs in my life. He gives me billboards. I mean, they are undeniable. They're awesome. They're just so awesome. And he repeats his name, and I'm like, and you are located where? Right around the corner. The church right around the corner from where I live. And he's the deacon now. So I said, actually, I just got back from our area assembly, and I have an area where and when that I would like to drop off to you, or get to you, I said. What's the address? He gave me the address. I'm like, it is the church around the corner. I'm going to bring it by right now, I told him. He said, you're bringing it by? I said, I'm bringing it by. I drove over, and I pulled into the parking lot, and I said to God, give me a sign. Let me know if it's him or not. Only thing I remember is that he smelled like stale smoke. And he was big. He was tall. And he was big boned. And he had a twin brother. Why I remember that, I have no idea. Two of them. Go figure. So, sometimes God helps at lunch, I think. But anyway. So I said, give me a sign, God. Just give me a sign. Let me know if it's him or not. So I went in. He was on the phone. And I looked at him. And I watched him. And there was no way. The guy was short and round. And it's not him. So, when I spoke with him, I gave him the book, and we talked about Al-Anon a little bit, and he said, you know, the only reason I knew to call the Highland Center was because I have a brother who's married and to an alcoholic, and she went into treatment, and I was really close to the situation because he's my twin. So, I ended that conversation fairly quickly and left, and I prayed for the next several weeks about what I needed to do, and it just didn't leave me. It just kept gnawing, and it wasn't so much that I need to blame or that man is responsible for anything. But what kept gnawing at me was that maybe I could spare someone else. Maybe I could spare another little girl just from being criticized. And I went back and I approached him one day, and he didn't remember. He didn't remember me. Somebody who affected me all my life with just words, just words. But he eventually began to cry, and he said, you know, I don't doubt what you say because I am very critical of people, and I do judge them from the way that they look. If I see a man with dirty hands, I think, he just must be a mechanic. He told me this. And what can I do? And what can I do to bring you back to the church? You know, I have a God of my understanding, and I don't have to go there. And I am whole and complete every day that I continue to work and put the pieces back together. But it left me because I did. God put the meat in front of me, and I sliced it and I diced it and I confronted it. And somehow I became a little bit more whole. And maybe I spared some other little child, and that's okay. One thing I learned when I had been in the program about a year, less than a year, one night I was, I don't know, my healing has a lot to do with water. I, you know, cry in the shower and miracles happen in the bathtub and stuff like that. But I was sitting in the bathtub, and my husband came home from a meeting one night, and he sat down on the floor, and I don't know what the conversation was, but I remember him eventually saying, you know, I don't know what else I can do. And this was about my resentment. This was just about resentments in general. You know, I call you if I think I'm going to be late. You know, I let you know where I am. You know, I don't do anything to make you worried. I just don't know what else I can do. And this moment of clarity came before me, and it was like, you know what? It doesn't matter how this stuff got inside me. It's mine. It doesn't matter who. It does not. It's
inside me, and it's my job and my responsibility to get rid of it. And it doesn't matter if that's the effects of somebody lying to me or somebody beating me up or somebody hurting me with their words or having sexually affected me. My losses are mine to deal with. What I've done, because I want to wrap this up so we maybe have some time for sharing, what I've done as these layers have come is I've worked on them. And I've come to know that I was taught early on that who I was defined by what I look like and what people thought. And that is so freeing today, not to care what people think. Not to care what people think that I look like. That I don't have to put my makeup on today to go to the grocery store. And used to, you know, I would because my dad's like, see me, I look like. It's very freeing. And when I'm free, I can be who I am. And I can investigate who I am because I take all the frill away. And I came to know that I owed my husband amends because I threatened. And I played games. And I manipulated. And accused. And tried to put the fear of God in him. For what? You know? For what? And where we are today is my husband has gotten to a place where he says, you know, I do desire you, but I am a man who doesn't need a lot of human touch. And you know that any time you approach me, I'm ready. But see, I just got tired of being the approacher. And in the beginning, I was the approacher. I was the assertive one. And somewhere along the line, in all my emotion, I changed the rules. And I thought, he's not opposed to me. I can help him still have an affair. But it wasn't the way it was in the beginning. I was the approacher. And somewhere along the line, I didn't want to be, and I wanted something different, and I didn't just say that. And today I know that what my husband is willing and able to do, he does. He gives me everything he's got in every area. And I created a whole lot of craziness in my life, and he didn't even need to be part of it. I could have lived alone and created this crazy stuff because the foundation was laid when I was 11 years old. And it grew, and it got taller and taller and taller. So I approached this stuff like I approached those defects in a fourth and fifth step. And I asked God to reveal. One day I was getting a massage. This was several years ago, and this woman, this is just, I can't believe it, I'm telling you the story, but, you know, she's massaging my gluteus maximus. For those of you that know where it is, you sit on it, okay? It's over here. And she's like, oh, you're holding a lot of memory here. And I said, well, you know, with the size of it, I could hold a lot of memory. And she said, do you know what to do about it? And I said, yeah, I did. And I didn't need to get into it with her, but I did know because Al-Anon taught me. Become willing. Tell God, I am willing to have this revealed to me. And oh my God, overnight, my life became hell. I knew something the next day that I didn't know the day before. And what the final step was in this sexual revelation was that with this infrequency of sex, every time I had sex with my husband, I felt like I was having sex with a stranger. And my soul didn't like it at all. And I was in pain at my core afterwards. I abused myself in doing that. That's why I never liked that. I, you know, with all this outward stuff, it was like, you know, you need to do this. You need to have candles. You need to do this. We need to do it more often. And when in reality, it was this stranger thing that I was doing, if that makes any sense to anyone. I would have never known this 15 or 20 years ago. But that's what was revealed to me. And there you go. Then what do you do with it, Donna? And I set out to just do some more work and some more journaling and some talking. And that's when I started talking about this subject in meetings. Had I ignored this part of my life, I would not be standing here whole and complete and able to accept every part of my life, every part of who I am. And, you know, there's been times when I even prayed that God would take my desire to be a woman away. Yes, that's how much pain I was in. Because I felt there was no outlet in which to celebrate it and be faithful in my marriage. So, God answers prayers in all areas of our life. And what I've come to know is that I made it a bigger deal than it was, but maybe I needed to make it a big deal to be able to get to it. I don't know, and that's okay. And that it was my responsibility to take care of it. And those other people all my life were insignificant. They really were. Because if I sit around and I stay in the problem, I cannot go to the solution. And I'm going to live in this soul-screaming pain all of my life. So today, that's what the life is, and I no longer have to play games, and I no longer have to be dishonest, and I no longer have to set myself up, or my husband. The Alateens, I like the Alateens. We've got good Alateens in Missouri, and, you know, often when I, and I'm sure you have them here, too, but, you know, they're kind of that forgotten part of the disease we just don't think about. And I have the opportunity to talk to my 11, last week, and my 11-year-old daughter, our granddaughter, and my 11-year-old niece, my brother's little girl. We went bra shopping. But how cool. I didn't have anybody to do that. And then my sister, who has no children, decided that because my niece doesn't have a mother, that she would take over that sex education part of Ashley's life. And so we went to Walden Books, and we bought sex education books. And we talked about it. And that's so cool today to be able to say that. And to be able to say to these girls, you know, you girls, when you get ready to be sexual, you need to think about it. Young girls get ripped off when they have sex. They really, really do. And we don't know how we scar ourselves and we carry that around for all of our lives. So all of my effects, I guess, probably weren't from alcoholism. I don't know that it started out that way. It did with my mother. I didn't even mention my wonderful mother. Who used to tell me that if I got pregnant, I would go to the unwed mother's home. And when I got married, by the way, she told me that I had to get married because, like dogs, my husband and I would probably never be kept apart. And so the sex was always there. Every joke that my mother used to tell, and she told a lot of them, all of them were about sex. Have you ever sat at a family dinner and your grandmother be at one end and your mother at the other end and your mom stand up and she throws the tail of the chicken and she goes, "Here, Mom, at your age, it's the only piece of you're going to get." I'm 13. I have a boyfriend for dinner for the very first time. You know, you get a distorted view. what this is all about. Yeah. Yeah, real strange stuff, not normal. And my mother did later have a problem with prescription drugs. So, yeah, I was dealing with that alcoholism attitude and behavior. So, with this, I'm going to close. But I hope that, I know a lot of times when I give this meeting, I see lots of tears, and I don't see a lot of tears today. So, I don't know what to say. It's really thrown me. But here's a few handouts. I don't have enough for everybody. It's got some words on there that might kind of stimulate some thought, like intimacy, mistrust. What I have here, the following words are thought-provoking in terms of our sexual relations. Of course, you may have more to add to the list. What is important is that we look at our side only. Once we have become affected in some way, perhaps by another person's behavior, sexual or otherwise, the effect belongs to us. It is our personal responsibility to rid ourselves of what blocks us from being as whole and as happy as we can be. And some of the words are intimacy, mistrust, spiritual, freeing, connection, loss, passion, dishonesty, vulnerable, secrecy. That's a good one. Pain, repulsion. Our books talk a lot about and discuss, and our literature talks somewhat about an alcoholic that smells or comes home drunk and that we're just repulsed. And can we get past that the next day? Boredom, validating. If I have sex with you, then I validate that I'm worthwhile or I'm loved. Loving, demanding, threatening, trust, manipulation, punishment, control, approval, jealousy, because I saw you look at someone, I'm going to wear you out. Fear, that I can't wear you out. Abandonment, surrender, sadness. How about this one? Conquer. Desire, rejection, motivation. You know, the list goes on. A couple of words that I add now is compromise. That's a good one. Compromise and choice. And compromise has been very important in me reaching a level of the acceptance of where I am today. So I'm going to wind this up because I know we have banquet time. And we, if you want to stay till 5:30, we've got 15 minutes for sharing. But let me say this. When anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, let the hand of Al-Anon and Alateen always be here. And let it begin with you. Thanks.
I know it looks rather funny for a 70-year-old woman to stand up here and want to share in a workshop like this. But, you can't hear me? Okay, I thought I was talking into a mic. I think it is strange that a 70-year-old woman wants to stand up here and share in this workshop. And it doesn't have anything, what I want to share doesn't have anything to do with the sex life of my married life with my husband. I was married to him for 47 years, and he died 6 years ago. I became a single woman in a world that I didn't know anything about because I got married at 17. And I went to a conference in October after he died in May, and this man said, "Well, come sit by me." I sat by him. And he said, "Well, let's eat our meals together while we're here." And when we left, he gave me his phone number and wanted me to call, his work number or his address number. He gave me his email number, you know, address. Well, I went home and he said, "Call him." So I talked to all these young girls I sponsor, and they say that I'm supposed to call this man. Well, it's a, you know, this is a new world. I had never called anyone in my life, and so I call him, and so he decides that he'll bring his little dog and come up to where I live, and we will get to know each other. And this was a rather awkward evening and awkward weekend, but we visited and everything, and you know, he looked at a picture of me when I was 16 on my refrigerator, and he said, "Man, you could turn me on if you still looked like that." And so I didn't pay any attention. I should have known. It should have been like a light bulb just went off. But I ignored it. And as the time went by, I went down there, but he didn't want to take me anywhere because I found out he didn't want to be seen with me. But I got him to let me go to an Al-Anon meeting while he went to the AA meeting. And this is one of my dealings with an alcoholic. And his sponsor had told him to find a good Al-Anon who worked a good program. And he was sure I was it. And then we were going to travel. We were going to go in a travel trailer and go all over the United States. But see, he wasn't going to be where anybody knew him or where I was known. We weren't going to be known where we were going. We went to a conference, and we didn't go together. His son was there, and he stayed with him, and I stayed with one of my sponsees. And We had breakfast. Well, they had a, what do you call it when you stand up and sing the words and stuff?
Karaoke.
Well, I'm good at that kind of stuff. And so, you know, I don't know what it's called, but I know how to do it. And so we went to the karaoke, and he was going to sing with his son and another gal, the one of our sponsors, and I said, can I do it too? And, well, he wasn't real happy about it, but I did. I'm not bashful. And so I went on and did that, and I realized how embarrassed he really, really was. He did not want me to sit next to him at this conference at all. I mean, he would just cringe. But, you know, he wanted other things, but not out in public. And so I, the next morning for breakfast, we were to have breakfast after his son left, and I said to him, okay, and we had breakfast, and while we were sitting there, I guess I had had an awakening about things, about me. I was taking things from this man that made me feel less than a woman. I just really, and here I was, the age I was, I want the young women, that's what I'm really, the young women in this group to realize that you don't have to take things from anybody, anywhere. And if they make you feel less than, run. Run fast. Run fast. Yes. At breakfast that morning, I had the courage, because of my program, because my God was right beside me, to tell this man that he told me, he said, I'm sorry, but I've always had a trophy on my arm, and you ain't no trophy. And so, I'll tell you what, that Sunday morning, when we had breakfast, I told him, I said, you know, I don't want to be a trophy on your arm, or anybody else's arm. I'm a trophy in my heart. I may not look good. That's okay. That's the way I am. And I said, my Al-Anon quit me for just a little bit. I said, I don't want to go with you anymore. And I said, you know, you ain't no Paul Newman either.
Something that I have believed more and more all the time. Now I'm 67 years old, been widowed twice, had the two best husbands in the world. The folks say is at least 90% medicine.
My name's Connie.
Hi, Connie.
And I'm from Maryville. And I just wanted to share a little something. This is something you talked about shortly, but that was about your sexuality in relation to the other people in your group. But I had a conversation today with one of the women in my group, and we talked about how when she first came to the meetings 3 years ago, she couldn't lift her head during the meeting. Her hair covered her face. And she never smiled. And she was always like this. Because she felt so beaten down by her situation. And the women in my group are mostly older women. And are wonderful big sister and role models to all of us in our group. And they taught not only her but myself to be beautiful for yourself. You don't have to be a beautiful, lovely human being just for somebody of the opposite sex. You can do it for yourself and feel good to be whatever you are, a man or a woman, and whatever your sexuality is and your sexual preference is, but you can treat yourself with respect and others with respect. And this woman comes, she dresses up, She's cleaned up. Her hair is brushed and beautiful. She smiles. She wears makeup sometimes. I used to come to meetings in overalls and a t-shirt. And it's not that I come to meetings now dressed up because I'm trying to compete, which was something I learned very early in life. You have to compete with the other women in the room by how you're dressed. But because we just all feel so good together, and somebody walks into the room and you go, we'll stop a meeting and say, wow, you look great in that color. You just look beautiful today. And they just grin from ear to ear. And just one last thing I want to say, the men in my experience has been, they've been so kind and respectful of myself and the other women I've been in meetings with. I know sometimes in AA it can feel like you've just walked into a bar. But and I'm also in that program, and I am guilty of that myself sometimes. But I would say in Al-Anon, I've gotten such great respect and love and care from the men in Al-Anon. And I think it has a lot to do with a lot of them are there for their children. And they're just there to share their experience, strength, and hope. And I want to say good things about you guys. Hi, Carrie. I just want to say something, too, about the young kids. You know, I'm older, too, and everything else, but I was my worst abuser when I was a teenager because I was always looking for...
Whoa, check it out!
Okay. I was always looking for, searching for that love of my dad. Any kind of abusive relationship you've had, whether it's verbal from your parents or alcoholic or things like that. So I would sexually abuse myself. I didn't care about my body. I didn't care what I did with other people. You know, it was like the boys with the notches on their belt. Well, I had a notch. You know, I had several notches. And then it didn't occur to me till I was, I don't know, maybe my 40s, that I was abusing myself constantly. And I didn't feel good about myself being a woman, you know, because nobody ever made me feel that way. And the young ones, you know, I look at them, I look at my daughter, and I think, don't ever, ever feel that way about yourself. You know, men or women, but specifically women, you know, don't ever, ever abuse yourself that way. Because it was like each time I did, I was raping myself, you know, and took a piece of me, you know, but at the time I didn't know it. So, thanks.
Thank you.
Take away all my pain. And that's a big price to have to put on sex. And I'm not doing that. I'm not out inflicting that pain today. And it's for the good of this program. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Probably enough time for one more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple of some people. I had the honor of meeting Louise Malfrin in about 1978. And I was standing next to her. She's a very, very fond woman. She was in her 80s. I think she was 82 at the time. And she had on this scarf and this black long dress. It was open all the way to the nose. And there was nothing there but just her ribcage. She was false eyelashes, makeup. She looked like a decent sculptor almost. And I had seen her before in pictures and I thought, you know, what would make a woman do that? That's just crazy. You know, all the women I knew that were in their 80s were And after meeting her she just included. It wasn't just sexuality, it was selfless. It was self-actualization. She even said in a paper on her, she said, if I had to do over, I would marry God Almighty. The reason that she dressed the way she did was that she had very little hair. She said, when I have people look at me, I don't want them to look at an old hag. I want to give them something to eat. And she said, I thought I was doing my part to explain it. She was right. I've had lots of problems with depression. And when you go into depression, you don't take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. Because it all starts on the inside. And then you don't like to do your hair. You don't do your makeup. You don't do anything. And since I've been at Al-Anon, I have felt such a love for the other women and the other people there that I make an excuse. When I go there, and one night, one of the girls in our room came, and the woman came. I was supposed to see that she had fixed her hair and put on makeup because her brother was dead. And I just looked at her the whole evening. I mean, she was gorgeous, and she cleaned up the environment, and she made my day. So that's loving. That is loving to respect and care about other people in that way. So what that's worth, I want you to share that because that's another aspect of Al-Anon and how we love each other.
Okay.
I was watching the starting part of the journey that got me to Adam. And what can literally be rescued for people? And I know that point in my life where someone can be trapped. I don't know where to go. What can you do to pay me up? If I'm going to use the camera, I think it was. Oh, then
Thanks. Shall we close?